ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Reading Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 17, The History of Kaliya, Text Number 10.
Minan
su dukkitan drishtva dina minapato hate kripaya sobharihi praha tatratya kshema acharam. Minansu dukkitan drishtva dinan minapato hate kripaya sobharihi praha tatratya kshemam acharam. Minansu dukkitan drishtva dinan minapato hate kripaya sobharihi praha tatratya kshemam acharam. Minan, the fish, sudukhitan, most unhappy. Drishtva, seeing. Dinan, wretched. Minapato, the lord of the fish. Hate, being killed. Kripaya, out of compassion. Sobhari, Sobhari. Praha, spoke. Tatratya, for those living there. Kshemam, the welfare. Acharan, trying to enact. Translation. Seeing how the unfortunate fish in that lake had become most unhappy at the death of their leader, Sobhari uttered the following curse under the impression that he was mercifully acting for the benefit of the lake's residents. In this regard, Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur explains that when our so-called compassion does not tally with the order of the Supreme Lord, it is merely causes a disturbance. Because Sobhari had forbidden Garuda's coming to the lake, Kaliya moved in and made his headquarters there, and this spelled doom for all the lake's residents. Srila Prabhupada ki Minan sudu kitan drishtva dinan minapato ate kripaya sobari praha tatratya kshema macharan. Seeing how the unfortunate fish in that lake had become most unhappy at the death of their leader, Sobhari uttered the following curse under the impression that he was mercifully acting for the benefit of the lake's residents. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharini Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatta Desha Tarini vañca kalpatarubhyascha kripa sindubhyeva cha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare, Hare Ram 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 Hare Hare. So Sukadeva Goswami continues the unfortunate story of Saubari Muni. And he explains in a slightly sarcastic way how Saubari Muni felt compassion towards all these fishes. And the reason for this is explained by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. It's simple. Saubari Muni got attached to the fishes. In the purport to the next verse, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur will say that that was Saubari Muni's asat sangha, being under the water and seeing all these fishes flowing around. He somewhat identified himself with all these fishes because he was under the water, the fishes were under the water. He was a part of their family. He was there, you know, sharing their happiness and distress. And he basically felt under this impression of asatsanga. It's funny because yogis, they are trying to avoid asatsanga. That's the main reason why they go high to the Himalayas or hide away in the forest, just to avoid the association with mundane creatures. But even there, they cannot avoid this because these creatures are all over them. it's not possible to really, by this artificial means, to create a situation of spiritual attachment, because even in these lonely or secluded places, you will still be associating with all these creatures and with their way of life, and you will get attached. And therefore, it is explained by Sukadeva Goswami here, because of this asatsanga, because of this stupid, crazy, even crazy attachment, to the point of craziness, he started cursing the great devotee of the Lord Garuda. This is the result of asatsanga. This is the result of course, and as a result of this, he fell down. As a result of this, he committed offense against Garuda and fell down. And this misplaced sentiment is being discussed here. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that he felt compassion towards this fish. But as a result of this compassion, Kaliya moved in. And Kaliya poisoned the whole lake. You know, he wanted good for these creatures when he saw this death from Garuda's hands. But instead of this, Kaliya moved in and everyone was suffering. So this misplaced sentiment, which goes against the will of the Lord, is basically, even though from the sentimental point of view, from the superficial point of view, it may be a good thing. It may be considered something very, you know, noble or something laudable. Ultimately, it's not good. In the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, the same kind of a dynamic is observed when Arjuna is moved by the sentiment. And from the external point of view, his sentiments are noble. He says, I don't want to kill my relatives. And Prabhupada, while explaining this, Arjuna says, Svajjanah Krishna, Drishtvimam Svajjanah Krishna, seeing my relatives in front of me, I'm full of compassion and the tears are flowing from my eyes. And Prabhupada says that there are two reasons why the tears can flow from the eyes of a person. One is the material fear. And he says, Arjuna is in Maya here. And another one he says, because somebody has a great feeling towards the Lord, then the same symptom can be there. So in other words, there is a bona fide compassion, and there is unbona fide compassion, compassion which is bad. And compassion which is bad is not compassion. It's the opposite number. It's actually not the compassion, because ultimately it doesn't bring good neither to the people who we feel compassion for, nor to ourselves. So, Prabhupada explaining this verse, Drishtve mam svajana Krishna, when Arjuna is telling Krishna, you know, I'm seeing this, or when Sanjay explaining this, that svajana, Srila Prabhupada says, this is rascaldom. Svajana, this conception that these people are mine. Like here, in this particular case, all these fishes, they were svajanah for Saubari Muni. They were his relatives, so to speak. He was closely related to them, and therefore he was cursing Garuda. And ultimately, this sentiment is misplaced, and this sentiment is stupid. This sentiment doesn't bring anything good to the people. Like Prabhupada, in one lecture, he was illustrating this with a funny story about the boy who was spoiled by his aunt. There was a boy, and his aunt was a very compassionate lady. She loved him very much, and she was fulfilling all his desires, all his whims. Whatever he would do, she would say, oh, my dear boy, you're alone. Your mother left you, you know, I'm taking care of you. And the boy, because he was being spoiled, because of this so-called compassion, he started stealing. And the aunt said, oh yeah, it's a nice engagement, yeah, go on, please, because this is good, you don't have to work so much, to work too hard, you know, you're getting all you need, please go on. And then the boy went on, and then he murdered somebody. And then he was about to be executed, and the aunt is standing there, and she's crying, you know, with the tears in her eyes. And the judge is asking the boy, would you like your last wish? Now you will be executed. Now we will shut you. What would you like? And he said, I want to say something to my auntie's ear. And the judge says, yeah, go ahead. And he comes to his aunt, and the aunt is crying, oh, my dear boy, and the boy, he bit the ear of the aunt. And I said, well, what did you do to me? Why? Why? I loved you so much. And he said, if you didn't love me that much, I wouldn't stand now here being executed. Because of your misplaced sentiment. Because of your stupidity, now I'm being executed, and this is your fault. She said, yeah, yeah, my dear boy. So, this material sentiment is always harmful. Material sentiment, because it ultimately goes against the grain, against the will of the Lord. This is what is being explained by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in the purport of this verse. Because people don't know the real will of the Lord, their compassion, which is superficially noble or good, superficially, it doesn't bring anything good. Ultimately, it creates havoc. It creates something bad. And our sentiments can only be good if they have the proper foundation. If the foundation of our sentiments are not good, then the sentiments are not good themselves. If you make a mistake on the first step, in the first step you make a mistake, then whatever you do afterwards will be mistaken. Even though it may be, by the external appearance, may look good, but it will be a mistake. Because the first step is wrong. You disregarded God. You forgot about God and His will, and therefore everything else, however logical it may be, will be wrong. This is the idea here, and we have to really remember about this, that compassion is good. Compassion is the noble quality. Actually, the compassion is the most prominent sign of a Vaishnava. It's interesting that in Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna explains to Arjuna the achievement in yoga, when he explains the summit of yoga, When he explained to Arjuna Samadhi, the most sublime state of consciousness. And after explaining Samadhi, Krishna goes on to explain how the Samadhi, or the state of complete absorption in the spiritual consciousness, is manifested externally. He goes on to explain different stages of Samadhi. And on the last stages, when he describes the highest achievement in yoga, he says that the highest achievement of somebody who is situated in the spiritual consciousness is that he sees happiness and distress of other people as his own happiness and distress. Sayogi paramam mama. He very clearly says, this is the supreme, topmost yogi. This is the best of the yogis who can feel the compassion towards others, who feels the distress of others as his own, and who feels the happiness of others as his own. And Prabhupada, he usually would repeat this phrase of Sanskrit phrase or Bengali phrase, paradukha dukhi. Vaishnava is paradukha dukhi, or parasukha sukhi. He feels the happiness of others, and he feels the distress of others as his own. And this is the greatest achievement in yoga, because that means that your ahankar, your false ego, the covering of your false ego is destroyed. You're capable of feeling the same feelings which others are feeling. And therefore you're rejoicing when others are rejoicing, and you're suffering when others are suffering. This is the meaning here, and this is the very sublime state of consciousness. There was one story about Kuresh. Kuresh, he was one of the closest associates of Ramanujacharya, one of his closest disciples. And once he was traveling through the forest, he was walking through the forest, and he saw a frog, and the frog was being swallowed by the snake. And usually, you know, I once noticed how they do this. You know, the snakes are a little narrow, and the frogs are fat. But somehow or other, because the snakes don't have so much bones inside, they can swallow. They are very flexible, so to speak. So, but because the frog is so fat and the snake is so narrow, it takes a long time to swallow. It goes on for a long time. So Kuresh was traveling through the forest, walking through the forest, and he saw this pitiful scene when the snake gradually was swallowing this frog. And it sometimes it takes hours. And it's a torture. And the frog all the time is crying. All the time the frog was, you know, croaking and crying. And Kuresh, when he saw this, he was struck with compassion. He saw this frog being swallowed by the snake and crying and yelling and, you know, trying to somehow or other to be saved. Because the frog at that time was calling, save me, save me, save me. But then Kuresh was thinking, you know, this frog is here in the forest and nobody is there to hear this pitiful cries of the frog. Nobody will be able to save her, to save it. And then he said, only if he would cry for God, only the Lord could save him in this particular moment. But he's not crying for God. He's just crying out of fear and out of pain. And then Kuresh started thinking that, isn't it the same ply is there for all the human beings? Mm. All the human beings are being swallowed by the snake of time. This is actually the standard metaphor in Sanskrit poetry. Sometimes the time is compared with the snake. It's a snake, and we're being swallowed by the snake of time. And it takes a long time. And in the meantime, we're crying, save me, save me, save me. We're suffering, you know, being gradually swallowed. Boom, boom. You know, our grays, our hairs become gray, you know, we become wrinkled, we become useless. And we're crying. But we're not crying for the Lord. We're crying just just because we feels like crying. We are not really crying for the real compassion. We are crying for the real grace of the Lord, but we are crying just because of helplessness. And Koresh, he fainted. Seeing this scene, he fainted. So much compassion he felt for this creature and for everyone. So ultimately, the compassion, and this is the definition of Vaishnava. And Prabhupada, he was always stressing this point, that the definition of Vaishnava is paradukaduki, the one who feels the suffering of others, the one who is not callous, the one who is not really, whose heart is melting. Chanakya Pandit, he says the same thing in his Chanakya Shlok. He says that yasya chitam dravi bhutam, he says that if somebody, yasya chitam dravi bhutam, is somebody's consciousness, is somebody's heart, is dravi bhutam. Dravi bhutam basically means liquid. If somebody's consciousness is liquid, so much so that he feels compassion towards everyone, then he says, for such a person, there is no need for any knowledge or any spiritual practices. He is already perfect. This is Chanakya. And Chanakya is not, of course, a real Vaishnava, but still, even from the normal moralistic point of view, the summit of knowledge or the summit of spiritual practices is this feeling of compassion. But the compassion has to be universal. That's the point here. The compassion should not be selective. We should not feel only compassion for our own people and don't feel compassion for everyone else. We have to feel compassion for everyone, and this is the sign of the spiritual achievement. Otherwise, if the sign is not there, the achievement is not there either. It is actually also Jiva Goswami very interestingly describes this situation in his Bhakti Sandarbha again. He says that the real cause of the mercy in this world is Krishna. Krishna is the source of all mercy. He is the source of grace. But then he says, but actually, Krishna's mercy is the secondary reason for our deliverance. He is explaining the cause, how the living beings in this world are being delivered. What is the cause for their deliverance? And he says, the reason for this is Krishna's mercy. But then he says, no, but actually Krishna's mercy is secondary. It's not that important. The real reason for our deliverance, the real reason for us being saved from the sufferings of this world, is the mercy of the saints. And he goes on to explain this. He says, look at Krishna. Krishna is so happy, you know, his happiness is so immense that he cannot really relate to our sufferings. For Krishna, it's really, you know, just imagine Krishna. He knows that our situation is totally artificial, that our sufferings are artificial and our happiness is artificial. We are conditioned living entities and we put ourselves into this artificial situation, and Krishna cannot really relate to this. He cannot really understand why we are suffering, you know, why we are suffering so much. And Jiva Goswami says, Krishna is so overwhelmed with his happiness that the pitiful cries of the living entities does not really touch his heart. But they touch the heart of the saints. He says that the mercy of the Lord is being invested, Kripa Shakti of the Lord is being invested into the consciousness of the saints. And this is the mystic process, because Krishna knows that compassion, you know, Krishna is compassionate ultimately. And the cause for our deliverance, the ultimate cause for our deliverance is his mercy. There is no doubt about it. But he invests his Kripa Shakti into the saints. And the saints, and then Jiva Goswami has to explain, how is that the saints can feel for our unhappiness? If Krishna is happy, saints are also happy. The saintly persons who achieved happiness of the spiritual world, they're also happy. They're on the same, more or less on the same level as Krishna himself. But then Jiva Goswami, he gives an example. He says that In the same way as somebody who just awoken from a bad dream, from the nightmare, you know, and he has awoken, and he doesn't already feel the, you know, the nightmarish fever of fear, but at the same time he still remembers the nightmare which was there, and he says, the saint, although he is very happy, although he is totally, completely blissful because of the spiritual experience which he has, still he can relate to the sufferings of the living entities because he still remembers the nightmare of material existence. He has just been there, you know, and he knows how it is to be in the nightmare. Therefore, he walks around and he sees all these people who are totally fearful because of this nightmare of their conditions. And he walks around, he cannot help but feel the compassion for these living entities. He really feels for them. And Jiva Goswami says, therefore, the primary reason for our deliverance is the mercy of the saint. He can relate to our sufferings and he can feel for this, and his heart melts when he feels this, when he sees this. You know, Shyamasundara Prabhu, he explains once that Prabhupada was driving through Mumbai. And Mumbai is a hellish city. There is no doubt about it. It's, you know, it's a hell, as every other city in the world, including San Diego. once
Prabhupada.
Yeah, right. Sometimes. We don't really understand that this is a hell. You know, once Prabhupada was interviewed on the TV in London, and the lady commentator asked, Swamiji, do you have a concept of hell in your religion? And Prabhupada said, yes, we have a concept of hell in our religion. London is hell. This is our concept of hell. And that was, you know, the next day in all the newspapers it was announced, Swamiji says London is hell. But Prabhupada was driving, Shyamasundara says, Prabhupada was driving through the city of Mumbai, and he saw these people. And in Mumbai there is a specifically, very specifically hellish invention. This is the trains in Mumbai. You know, that they have this system. It's a huge city which is long, you know, along the beach it's stretched. And the trains, you know, once I was there in a rush hour, trying to get in the train. That's really hellish, you know. If you want to get on the train in Mumbai in the rush hours, you know, you will be trampled and you will be squeezed and you will be hurt and you will be, you know, it's huge snakes of these trains, and they swallow people. They're swallowing people. You know, thousands of people are packed in these trains. And Shyamasundara Prabhu said that Prabhupada was driving through Mumbai in the car, and he saw these crowds of people attacking the trains, trying to get in or get out, you know, these huge crowds. And Prabhupada started crying. The tears were flowing from his eyes because of the compassion. Because he felt, you know, all these people, they are living this totally, completely hellish life, without any reason for this, without any benefit ultimately. They're going, you know, 2 hours by train, 2 hours back by train, getting few rupees, you know. They're getting 10 rupees for their whole day work, without any benefit for themselves, without any benefit for anyone else, and just because for nothing they're doing this. And Prabhupada was crying. And actually this state of consciousness, compassionate state of consciousness, the reason for this is explained by Rupa Goswami in Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu. This is also very interesting. How is that? How is this compassion comes to the consciousness of a saint? Actually, the reason for this, paradoxically described by Rupa Goswami, the reason for this melting of consciousness of the saint is the enjoyment. Rupa Goswami, he gives a very brilliant explanation for this when he explains or describes the state of bhava. The explanation, that the reasoning for this is as follows. Bhava is a very blissful state of consciousness. And even, you know, even the material sentiments, because material sentiments can also be called bhava. But material sentiments, the problem with material sentiments is that they're very temporary, they're fleeting. Sometimes we feel great happiness within ourselves. Sometimes we feel kind of a little shade of a bhava. And some kind of emotion comes to our heart. Because ultimately the life is about emotions. If you don't feel any emotion, you're miserable. So when we feel some kind of material happiness, then bhava is coming. But bhava is temporary, it's fleeting. This is the definition of bhava. In Amar Kosha dictionary, it is said that bhava, by definition, bhava means becoming. Literal meaning of this word, bhava, means becoming. It means, you know, the state of mind, it's some temporary, transitionary state of mind. The mind is taking the shape of emotion, but then emotion very quickly vanishes. It goes away from the mind. And Rupa Goswami says that because we're hankering for emotions, we're hankering for this happiness of bhava, of this emotional happiness. But usually we don't feel this. Usually we feel, you know, really bored. You know, it's really bored or whatever. You know, there is no emotions in the heart. Even when we, you know, jump in a kirtan, we're jumping, and deep inside we're doing what we're doing. You know, there's no emotion, doesn't come. Bhava doesn't come. But we're hankering for bhava. We're here only for this experience of this emotional happiness, which has the nature of bhava, of the very sublime state of emotion. And because of this, we become cruel. We're hankering for this, we get little drop of this happiness in this material world, little drop of emotion, but this drop of emotion cannot really satisfy our thirst. You know, we're in this desert of material consciousness or material existence, and a little drop of emotion we experience here and there, and it doesn't satisfy, and therefore we become even more cruel. We want by all means to snatch, to steal these emotions. But Rupa Goswami, he explains that when bhava descends from the higher plane, when the real bhava, when the real spiritual emotion descends from the higher plane of existence, then what happens, it completely occupies our mind. And it becomes one with the mind. Srila Prabhupada says that the quantum of the mind becomes occupied with bhava. And the comparison is there in Srimad Bhagavatam, that when you put the iron rod within the fire, it becomes fiery, it accepts the same nature. So when the spiritual emotion comes to the mind, then the mind becomes of the nature of spiritual emotion. And because the nature of spiritual emotion is permanent, it doesn't leave you so easily, then the mind, the quantum of the mind, becomes melted because of so much happiness. And because of this melted condition of the mind, of the consciousness, on the stage of bhava, this melted condition of the mind transforms itself into compassion. The compassion is not, it's actually the experience of the happiness of the spiritual world, which is manifested towards the living beings of this world. It's the same sentiment. So also the same thing is Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he's saying that the very same sentiment which is experienced as love of Godhead, the very same sentiment, the very same love of Godhead, the same emotion towards the living being of this world is experienced as compassion. It's not different. If you love God, you have to be compassionate. And if you are compassionate, if your compassion is unrestricted, if you feel compassion towards all living beings, it means you love God. And this is the real compassion, which is not, which is beneficial for everyone. And this is what is being stated. This is the state of compassion which we have to achieve. When we achieve this sublime state of bhava, then the real compassion comes, because the heart melts. And because it melts of the happiness of spiritual world, you want to share the same happiness with everyone. You want to give the same happiness to everyone. And therefore, you manifest your compassion properly. But if you don't have this experience, this happiness of spiritual world, then you will not be able to manifest the real compassion, the real spiritual compassion towards all the living entities. And that's basically the proper, this is the proper compassion. And improper compassion will always be material, will always be stupid. You know, we will be compassionate. Sometimes it's also a phenomenon of this world. Sometimes people are so sentimental and so compassionate towards some little creature, towards some little dog which they have. And at the same time, they totally cruel towards everyone else. You know, they may be, my little dog, you know, like also Hridayananda Maharaj, he says that in this country, meaning America, of course, glorious American country, you know, if you torture a dog, if you don't give food to a dog or whatever, if you do something bad to a dog, you will be put in prison. But at the same time, if you kill cows, in thousands and hundreds of thousands, that's fine, that's okay, no problem. You know? He says, how is that proper? You know, if you do something little to a dog, you're bad. And if you kill cow, that's okay, that's not a problem, that's fine. So this is the way of inconsistency of the material sentiment. If material sentiment is there, it will always be inconsistent. Because the foundation is not proper. But if we have the proper foundation for our life, this proper foundation is only one. That is Krishna consciousness. The proper foundation is to understand actually there is will of the Lord, and we have to follow the will of the Lord. And when we do this, then the real compassion manifests in a proper way. And this compassion will be beneficial. Otherwise, our so-called compassion will be harmful, will be actually really bad. You know? And we can see so many examples in this material world of this so-called compassion. You know, like nowadays, this so-called compassion of euthanasia, they're trying to, you know, kill people because of compassion. You know, all these poor people, they're suffering so much, let them be killed or whatever. So many other controversial subject matters of this world, but all these controversies are only controversial as much as we don't have the proper foundation of Krishna consciousness. When we do have this Krishna consciousness, then everything comes into place. Everything becomes proper. And then our compassion becomes proper, our sentiments become proper, and everything else becomes proper. Whereas when we don't do this, everything which we do, it's totally ridiculous. Really ridiculous. It really doesn't make any sense. And this is exemplified by Sobari Muni. He's so compassionate, though poor leader of the fishes is being killed. Let me curse Garuda. And we know the result of this. He fell down, and all the poor fishes were suffering because of this poison of Kali snake. Okay, thank you very much. Yes.
Well, maybe you can read it. This is the last sentence of the first chapter. Throughout the first chapter, Prabhupada, especially towards the end, is okay. Passion or tune for being completely in mind. But then at the end,
I know.
You know that sentence?
I know that sentence, yeah. Yes.
Should I read it?
Yes, please.
Observing the situation of his enemy, Arjuna stood up on the chariot, but he was so afflicted with lamentation that he sat down again, setting aside his bow and arrows. Such a kind and soft-hearted person in the devotional service of the Lord is fit to receive self-knowledge. And then, interesting, the second chapter starts and Krishna gives him knowledge. So it appears like even the mundane sentiments of this kind of soft heart is
has its place.
It has its place. Yeah, it's.
See, Arjuna is a great person, and even when a great person is in Maya, he's still great. Arjuna is magnanimous, and Krishna definitely condemns his misplaced sentiment. From the very beginning of the second chapter, he's saying, Arjuna, you're in Maya. Anarya jushtam asvargyam, he says, you know, how's that? How is this petty mindedness can enter into your heart? You know, and he's saying this is all bad. He's saying it's all petty mindedness because this is not proper. But still, Arjuna is great, and because he is great, and because of this greatness, it's also a sign of greatness of his heart. Yes, now he's somewhat bewildered. Prabhupada actually also, in this regard, quotes the sentiments of Maharaja Yudhisthira. In the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is said that Maharaja Yudhisthira, after the this war of Kurukshetra, was totally morose and totally depressed, being compassionate to all those people who were killed. And specifically, it is said there in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam that he was moha, he was in maya, he was an illusion. Moha means illusion. Moha sneha. Because of this sneha, he was bewildered. He was, and Prabhupada, he quotes the same kind of situation to Maharaja Yudhisthira. But at the same time, we have to understand that the heart of a devotee is soft. And therefore, the softness of the heart, even if it's sometimes not properly manifested, still it's a sign of his greatness. Whereas the heart of a conditioned living being is usually very hard, and he doesn't feel this compassion. So Srila Prabhupada, he actually glorifies Arjuna, and I believe, I'm not 100% sure, but I can check it. I think he follows in this particular verse Madhvacharya, his commentary on this verse. And Madhvacharya, he also explains that even though Arjuna was in Maya, still his compassion was glorious, because Duryodhana was also in Maya, but he didn't feel compassion. He was just manipulative, and he was just, you know, only thinking about achieving his ends, and he was selfish. Therefore, even this, you know, when the glorious person is in a bewildered situation, still his bewilderment is manifest in a glorious way, in a noble way, so to speak. Whereas if we are not noble, we will manifest our bewilderment in a very obnoxious way. This will not be good at all. So that's, I believe, his explanation. And another, of course, yeah, anyway. Okay. Yes.
I have two questions. One is akin to this. I'm trying to think how to ask it. We sometimes see in devotees a type of harshness that is due to an aversion of, you know, they're afraid of being sucked in by being compassionate, or which even just being courteous or just being genial in the sense of a naturally warm person. Devotees can sometimes be a little cold or harsh. And also sometimes it can breed a type of arrogance. Well, you're completely in Maya, and you know, and you're just a fool, and I'm a devotee. So, you know, when one's on the, as you were saying, when one actually has pure love of God, then the very symptom of that is one becomes warm and compassionate, the real true sense of compassion. But in the interim, for those of us that are, we're sort of the worst of the two worlds. We don't really have pure devotion, so we don't have the pure compassion, but at the same time, we don't have any compassion. We're sort of in limbo there. So what is your advice for those of us in this state?
Yeah, sometimes we take this cruel side, being totally philosophical. And Prabhupada, he said, and that when you're only philosophical, He was, there is this famous statement in Bhagavad Gita that there is a religion and there is a philosophy, right? And religion without philosophy is a pure sentiment or sometimes fanaticism. And philosophy without religion is a mental speculation. So sometimes we tend to go to this philosophical side of the issue and we are taking this philosophy which is, you know, one has to be equal in happiness and distress, in honor and dishonor, especially if it's happiness and distress of others, you know, then you can be really equal. And it's your happiness and distress, it remains to be seen. We sometimes tend to be very compassionate towards ourselves, but forget the same sentiment. But that's the sign of mental speculation, because our philosophical, we have to have the philosophical kind of point of view, definitely. But at the same time, this philosophical point of view, without the religious sentiment, without bhakti was in the heart, it doesn't bring any good to people. When we hammer them on the head with the philosophy, without first manifesting the compassion towards them, then this philosophy doesn't really help them. This is not, you know, this is not good. So I think we have to be a little more normal in this regard. And we have to really, in our practice, we have to combine these two parts of our practice. We have to be religious in a sense that we have to be sentimental, in a good sense of the word. Sentimental and compassionate and understanding, but at the same time we have to have a very strong and philosophical understanding. And this combination of these two only can help. Whereas when we go to one extreme or another extreme, that will not be good. So it's a question of balancing these two sides.
Can I ask my second question?
Yeah.
Thank you, Marcia. And not that I'm arguing with Jiva Goswami, who am I to be, you know, worth even the question of such a thing. So to help me have a fuller understanding of the statement of Jiva Goswami,
mm-hmm.
that really Krishna's absorbed in his own happiness, and it, you know, the Christians give that example of Jesus, that Jesus, God, took the flesh and suffered on the cross, and therefore he could feel what we could feel, and, you know, Jesus is the intermediary with God. So it sounds almost like something similar to that. And yet we have, Krishna comes as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you know, he comes as Lord Nityananda, so the very embodiment of compassion.
It's actually also explained by Krishna Das Kaviraj when he explains the manifestation of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He says, Parama Karuna Rasika Shikara. And these two characteristics are there in Lord Chaitanya. And he's Parama Karuna, he is supremely merciful. Parama Karuna. And his Rasika Shikara means he takes this ras, this experience of ras, to the highest extent. Rasika Shikhar, he's the best of the Rasikas, the best of the enjoyers of this thing. But of course, and these two characteristics of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu are connected. He's Paramakarun because he's Rasika Shikhar. He experienced so much happiness himself, and therefore he's so compassionate, he wants to share this happiness with others. But also we should not forget that when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu comes, he comes in the mood of a devotee. Whereas the Supreme Lord, he is the supreme enjoyer, he is the supreme autocrat. The compassionate part is a compassionate part. Srimati Radharani is the compassion personified. She is the compassion. She is also a devotee, the supreme manifestation of devotion towards the Lord. So what Jiva Goswami, Srila Jiva Goswami wants to say that, you know, and Srimati Radharani and Krishna are the same. They're not separate. She is his Shakti, but she is his Kripa Shakti. So Krishna himself as God, his duty is to enjoy. He is on the receiving end. He is receiving the enjoyment. He is receiving the service. And that's his more or less his nature. He receives the mercy, he receives the service, he receives the enjoyment, and he is overwhelmed with this enjoyment. And therefore, it is another part of Krishna who is manifested as Srimati Radharani and as his pure devotees. They are manifesting compassion, which is ultimately coming from him. So it's ultimately coming from Krishna. It's his kripa shakti, but it's invested with.
You go to the right department.
Yeah. It's invested in a vehicle. Srila Jiva Goswami also says that kripa shakti, every energy or every god has its vehicle, vahana, Garuda is the vahana of Krishna or Vishnu or. The peacock is the vahan Skanda, and so on and so forth. So, in the same way, Jiva Goswami says that that Kripa Shakti of the Lord also has its vehicle. And the vehicle, vahana, for Kripa Shakti is the devotee, the heart of the devotee. It sits there and it rides on the heart of a devotee as its vahana. So that's how it is. Krishna invests his kripa shakti within the heart of a devotee, and the devotee manifests his compassion to the highest, fullest extent.
This is in relation to Mahatma, who was question. Prabhupada was in Mauritius, and one guest challenged him that how is it that someone who is educated can behave in a ridiculous way? So then he explained that Arjuna, having heard the entire Bhagavad Gita, when he heard that his son Abhimanyu had been killed, he became completely distressed and was lamenting. So he challenged Prabhupada that how can that be? After hearing Bhagavad Gita, he's educated, but he's completely in distress. So Prabhupada said that is normal. That is a human reaction.
It's human sentiment.
And temporarily, he may have been distressed, but his victory was that he carried out the order of Krishna and he continued to fight. So temporarily he may have been disturbed.
Thank you for this clarification. That's a fact. Prabhupada, he explained this point several times. He said that the glory of Arjuna was that he didn't stop his service because of his sentiments, so to speak. And we see that in this particular situation, before Bhagavad Gita was spoken, the same kind of attitude is still there, because Arjuna is depressed, but whom he is coming with his depression to, he's coming to Krishna. And he's asking, please dispel my doubts, please help me. He's coming to God, and that means that he's glorious, despite of all these emotions which may not be so laudable in this particular point of time. But still, he's coming to Krishna. He's asking Krishna to help. He's still in the mood of his servant. Yes. And that means that he's servant of Krishna, even if he's temporarily somewhat bewildered.
Yesterday, when we were discussing at breakfast, you made a point that there's a very strong theme of renunciation and detachment in the scriptures, because in a healthy culture, there's normally a lot of attachment to family and friends and so forth. But it seems like, in especially Western cultures, but all over the world now, there's this voidism and personalism. Mm-hmm. So then when you take the emphasis of renunciation and detachment of the scriptures and sort of superimpose it on this environment, then you really get into this
zoo.
We had this discussion up in Vancouver last summer that Gloria was talking about how we're sort of predisposed impersonalists, so you have to really sort of, knowing that that's our condition, really sort of make an extra effort to be very personal.
Therefore, when Krishna describes or even defines bhakti, it's actually very interesting. In the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, where he gives a definition of bhakti, or not the bhakti, of adhikar for bhakti. He gives a standard definition of somebody who is qualified to be a bhakta. He says it's somebody who is not too attached and not too detached. That's the qualification. If you are too attached, this is the adhikar for materialism. If you are too detached, this is the adhikar or qualification for impersonalism. He says somebody who is not too detached and not too attached, but somebody who developed the faith in my katha, matkathasu, who has developed the faith in the stories of Krishna, in Krishna katha, and Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. This is the adhikar for bhakti. The faith, Shraddha, for this, for Krishna's katha. But this is the main qualification, the faith into the Krishna katha. But the secondary qualification is not too attached and not too detached. So if we are too detached, it may be detrimental because we become impersonalist. Because we always stress this point, you know. Be detached, detached, detached. It means that we don't care about Krishna. It ultimately means we care about salvation. We care about the liberation, mukti. So, yes, we have to be attached, we have to be properly attached. Where should be our attachment placed? It should be placed into Krishna Katha. And when it's placed into Krishna Katha, the consciousness becomes very, very human, so to speak. It really becomes, it doesn't become dry and hard and cool as the consciousness of impersonalist, because there is a very, you know, tender spot in the heart. This tenderness should be there. Otherwise, you know, if the tenderness is not there, we will just, maybe we will attain mukti, maybe, in the best possible case scenario, but we may attain some kind of strange liberation. We may become, you know, Prabhupada said that impersonalism becomes the trees. Yeah. Because trees don't suffer so much. They just stand there for many years. So it may happen to us.
You're very silent. Good meditation.
Yeah, yeah. But it's very perfect yogis. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.